Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
This is New Books in National Security, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Beth Windisch. My guest Ariel Aram wrote the book Break All the Borders, Separatism and the Reshaping of the Middle East. Ariel Aram is an associate professor in the Virginia Tech School of Public and International Affairs. Ariel, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
In Break All the Borders, you talk about separatist movements in the Middle East and North Africa since the 2011 Arab uprisings. How did you come to write about this topic?
There was a lot of discussion surrounding the uprisings of 2011 that the states of the Middle East could break apart into a million pieces. We saw this a lot in the discourse of the region. There are a lot of maps that were being generated about countries breaking into five, six, seven different segments, ethno-sectarian fragmentation. What I noticed, though, was that countries were actually breaking apart along predictable fault lines. That the separatist movements that were trying to redesign borders and adjust borders to reflect what they thought was a more organic, more stable political reality, were often movements that had originated in the early 20th century. So what I wanted to write about was how these separatists were setting up their own counterstates in relationship to the states that had existed in 2011.
Our listeners can't see it, so I'll describe the cover of the book. It looks like a photo of a military checkpoint. And when we were talking, you mentioned you had a different cover in mind originally. What happened?
Part of the writing of this book, I was a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. My daughter, who was in kindergarten at the time, would come to my office, and she was really interested in the materials that I had collected, the kind of piles of research materials. And occasionally, I would also take her on meetings if she didn't have school to talk with some journalists and other people who were involved in it. And she became really interested in this topic, and she designed a cover for the book that took the flags of each of the separatist movement and kind of made it into a big crayon-filled mismatch. Unfortunately, the publisher wasn't so keen on having a six-year-old design the cover, but it's still in my files, and someday maybe if we do a second edition, I'll let her cover show up somewhere.
You described the different disciplinary approaches to looking at separatist movements, from comparative politics and sociology to international relations to historical analysis. Can you talk about how you developed your methodology and talk a little bit about this interdisciplinary approach?
The question of separatism really sits on a seam in the way social scientists imagine that states emerge. International relations specialists tend to look at the emergence of states as a function of the global system. And so they like to think of they think of separatism, the efforts to try and create new states, as inherently involving the actions of other states. On the other hand, comparative politics tends to look at the functions inside states, the domestic politics of states. And so when they look at separatists, they think, well, there's must be something deficient or problematic in the internal politics of the states. And these are groups that are trying to break away to create their own states. So it becomes a kind of domestic level trauma. I'm much more comfortable, and I think a more effective way to think about these things is to think about it the way historical sociologists do. States are not things that exist spatially, but also things that exist in time. And we can imagine the rise and fall of states coming in waves. What I tried to do with the book was show how historical timing and opportunities that have been provided by changes in the way the world worked changes in the norms, changes in structures, changes in the global distribution of power, created opportunities for separatists to push forward to try and create new states. And often, though, by building out their historical linkages, by claiming a historical legacy to state-making movements that had failed in the previous generations.
You begin with an examination of the post-World War I Wilsonian moment. Can you talk about what was happening in the region at this time and the legacy of the time period?
There's a short version and a long version to this answer. I think anyone who's done any studies in the Middle East is familiar with the short version, that at the end of World War I, the British and French were dividing up the former Ottoman territories in the Middle East, and they came to the peace negotiations with an idea of a map that they wanted to draw, based largely on an agreement between Mark Sykes and Francois Picot. Woodrow Wilson intervened. He insisted on the creation of a League of Nations and some kind of mandate structure that would allow some measure of self-determination to come forward. And so the states that ended up emerging in Syria, in Iraq, in Jordan, Palestine, but also to a lesser extent, also in Egypt and North Africa, were kind of bastardized versions of self-determination, that they ended up fulfilling neither the ideas of the colonialists nor of the people involved. That's the short version. As we come up on the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I, there's been a new kind of historical reevaluation. It's not that these things weren't known, but that no one had really seen the whole picture. The longer story is that what happened at the end of World War I was there were myriad groups pushing to try and get the attention of great powers, particularly of President Wilson. This included groups in the Middle East, Arab nationalists, Kurdish nationalists, Zionists, Assyrian nationalists, Armenians. There were hundreds of different ideas about how the region could be redrawn to create a more stable political system. And globally, we also saw the emergence of nationalist movements pushing to try and get the attention of Wilson. Ho Chi Minh was then a waiter at a hotel in Paris. He tried to get a meeting with President Wilson. Saad Zalul, who was the head of the anti-colonial opposition group in Egypt, also tried and failed to get a meeting with Wilson. So there was this kind of moment of opportunity in the global structure, kind of a critical juncture, is what sociologists call it, where nationalist movements thought that they had a chance to really to get the attention of the international community and perhaps get permission for the international community to create states. In the end, the great powers, the US, Britain, France mostly, but also other European powers, kind of dithered. They favored some and disfavored others, largely for kind of, not for any particular reasons, but of convenience. And so some groups got states and other groups got left out of the international system. And they became kind of pariahs. They were forced to live in a state system that they hadn't designed and which they had actually deliberately tried to oppose. So there were these brief moments in the 1920s, immediately after the end of World War I, where certain groups thought that they could still break through. There were a number of Kurdish rebellions that came all the way from in Turkey, in Syria, and then Iraq. There were uprisings in Libya against the reinsertion of Italian colonialism. So there were uprisings in Morocco. All over the region, there were groups that thought that the international community might be accepting of their push for statehood now. In the end, only a handful of them broke through. What I talk about in the book is how those early experiences of failed state formation, kind of rebutted state formation, the unacknowledgement of the international community, set the stage for reassertions when states failed in 2011.
Sykes-Picot has become a shorthand to refer to the mismatch between identity and contemporary political institutions in the Middle East. However, you point out that narrative doesn't tell the whole story, especially as it may minimize the agency of indigenous actors. Can you talk about the colonial legacy and how you incorporated other key factors in your historical analysis?
The idea of using Sykes-Picot as a shorthand, as it often is in the Middle East, is misleading on a couple of different levels. It's misleading first because Sykes-Picot agreement really only dealt with Syria and Iraq, right? It has nothing to say. They said nothing about North Africa, nothing about Yemen, nothing about Turkey, nothing about the Arabian Peninsula, really. So even if you're blaming Sykes-Picot, the agreement for certain things, right, that doesn't account for what happens, for instance, in Tunisia or Libya, or Morocco, or Egypt. Secondly, the agreement itself was never really implemented. the division of the territorial division that the British and French reached after at the end of the war was roughly similar to what Sykes-Picot had imagined, but structurally was very different. Right, Sykes-Picot had not anticipated a mandatory structure for the under the League of Nations, and it had not really accommodated the idea that there would be any kind of sovereignty for any group within the region. What happened at the end of the war was almost the opposite of what Sykes-Picot had imagined. You did see states emerge that were kind of provisionally sovereign. That was what the mandates were. The mandate for Iraq, the mandate for Syria, the mandate for Transjordan was based on this idea that these countries would soon be independent states. They would not be colonies. That's not what Sykes-Picot had envisioned.
Following World War II, you speak to the landscape of the Middle East and North Africa, and that many newly recognized states included ethno-sectarian cleavages, but there was a tendency for those groups to make demands for inclusion rather than seek separate states. Can you talk more about this?
Sure. The end of World War II saw a kind of a second iteration of the League of Nations idea of self-determination becoming the basis for sovereignty and for statehood. The problem was that the states that gained independence after World War I, as well as after World War II, often didn't meet the full criteria for self-determination. They had significant internal cleavages. There were groups that wanted their own independence but were stuck within these states. The international community reached a strange kind of compromise at that point. They recognized states as existing, as carrying the mantle of self-determination, but at the same time, they said that the statehood was going to be fixed. Territorial borders were going to be unadjustable, immutable. What that meant was that if you were a minority group living in Iraq or Yemen or Syria, and you had once imagined that you could have your own political entity, well, the chances of having a new border of borders being redrawn and recognized by the international community were now very, very slim. So you had to work within the structures of states. And what you saw was a shift in the way minority politics operated across the region. The Kurds are a great example of this. There had been numerous uprisings in the 1920s and 1930s where Kurds had tried to create their own Kurdish state, both in Syria, both in Iraq, lesser extent in Syria, also in Turkey. By the 1950s and 1960s, Kurds weren't demanding their own state. They said, well, we realize we don't have any other choice anywhere to go besides to be Iraqi or Turkish or Syrian. But what we would like to have is some kind of cultural or territorial autonomy within the state. That's very different than the outright secessionism that had characterized the 1920s and 1930s. States had a kind of centripetal pull. The more the international community committed to keeping state structures alive, the harder it was for separatist movements to seem viable. That didn't mean that political opposition was gone. It just meant that political opposition was being funneled into a certain trajectory that was focused on taking power at the center, not breaking away from the state.
The book centers around case studies of Libya, Yemen, Kurdistan, and the Islamic State. Why did you pick these case studies?
When we look across the region at the countries that were affected by the uprisings in 2011, separatism really only became a factor in certain countries. There was almost no separatist mention in Tunisia, Egypt, no separatism, Bahrain, no separatism. Only certain countries were affected by separatists. So I wanted to look at those countries where separatists became a major factor in the politics of the country as the country was collapsing. So we knew that there were separatist movements active in Yemen and in South Yemen and in Kurdistan and Iraqi Kurdistan before the uprisings. There were established parties that were pushing for the reinstatement of lost sovereign territory. The reinstatement of South Yemen, which had existed as an independent state from 1967 until 1991, and the reinstatement of Kurdistan, which had existed in the 1920s in various kind of short-lived forms. What was more surprising, though, was the emergence of separatist movements in Libya, where people had really not thought of it, that there was any significant ethnic or sectarian cleavage that would push separatism. Additionally, the Islamic State, I think, caught everyone by surprise. My read of the Islamic State, and this is a kind of a controversial read, is that the Islamic State is a black sheep in the separatist fold. The Islamic State represented a Sunni separatist movement that emerged along the borders between Syria and Iraq, an attempt to reinstate a system of Sunni Arab supremacy that had been lost with the arrival of a Shia-dominated government in Iraq in 2003 and also an Alawi-dominated government in Syria in the 1960s and 1970s. So those were the four positive cases of separatism that emerged in 2000 and that appeared in 2011. I could have also done a study of a negative case, right? We take a look perhaps at Bahrain, where there was a great deal of political contestation and very significant ethno-sectarian cleavages. But there were no calls to create a separate state within Bahrain. The main political fight was about who would get control over the central government. That's different than what we saw in Libya, Yemen, Kurdistan, and the Islamic State.
I'd like to hear more about the case studies. Could you start off by telling us what you observed in Libya?
Libya was one of the most interesting countries to do research in and on because it's a country that I think even Middle East specialists knew very little about before 2011. You could really kind of count on two hands the number of American researchers that were spending significant amount of time thinking about Libya before the uprisings. So there was a lot to learn for me, and there was a lot to learn, I think, for the international community as they approached Libya. Most of the politics of Libya, most of the analysis of Libya has focused on who will get control over the central government in Tripoli. What I was interested, though, in was that the emergence of a separatist movement in eastern Libya, what in English we call it Cyrenaica, which is the ancient Greek word, Arabic called Barka. Where had this separatist movement come from? Where had this movement pushing for the creation of a new territory in eastern Libya emerged? And what I found was that these were groups that were seeking to reinstate a political history that had really gone extinct in 1951 with the creation of the Unified Kingdom of Libya. When I talked to leaders of the separatist movements in Libya, and also to journalists and people who were historians, people who were kind of more attuned to Libyan politics, one of the things that they emphasized was that many of the groups involved in the separatist movement came from some of the Arab tribes of the Green Mountains that had been closely associated with the first monarchy, with the Senussi monarchy of Libya, and that previously had been involved in the Emirate of Cyrenaica, which is this kind of quasi-independent entity that had appeared and then disappeared in the 1920s and then reappeared in the 1940s. They were pushing this idea that Cyrenaica had once been autonomous and once really been independent, and that Libya had done them no good, that Libya had been a chance to create a unified Libya. It had failed. And now the international community should consider reinstating the sovereignty of Cyrenaica in order to improve security. Cyrenaica would be the kind of the protector of Libya's oil. Most of Libya's oil is in the east, so it would belong to Cyrenaica. The Cyrenaican tribes were also vociferously opposed to the Muslim Brotherhood and also to other Islamist groups, which the international community was worried about taking over in Libya. So there was an opportunity to create a partnership between the separatist forces in eastern Libya and the global community.
When we're talking about Cyrenaica, it's interesting because that is where we see the city of Benghazi. And Gaddafi was not as connected to that region. We saw more power centralized in Tripoli. Can you speak to the role this history played in the more recent events in Libya?
Sure. Gaddafi is from Sirte. He's actually from a small tribe directly in between, equidistant between Benghazi and Tripoli. So between what had been the old capital of the Cyrenaican Emirate and what became the new capital of the Libyan mass republic, the Libyan Republic. Tripoli and Tripolitania, the province, is by far the largest, the richest, most populous part of Libya. Cyrenaica had always been a relatively underdeveloped, rural, tribal. But with the advent of oil there in the 1930s, it had its own kind of economic strength that Tripoli didn't have. The first king of Libya, Idris Senussi, was from Cyrenaica, and he always seemed to favor Cyrenaica. He favored the tribes of Cyrenaica. He trusted them much more than he trusted Tripoli. He had very negative things to say about Tripoli, but Tripoli was the kind of cultural and commercial center of the country. And so Libya evolved a system where they, in the 1950s, where they divvied up political and economic power between Tripolitania and Cyrenaica, even though Tripolitania by demographics, you know, probably should have had more strength. When Gaddafi seized power in 1969, he tried to disempower Cyrenaica. Now, it's not clear that Gaddafi had any particular animus against Cyrenaica. He distrusted a lot of different groups, and he hurt a lot of different groups in his time in power. But from a Cyrenaican perspective, this was a kind of a deliberate slight. This was a way of putting the interests of Tripoli and Tripolitanians over the interests of Cyrenaica. And it led and it contributed to the emergence of a kind of a Cyrenaican nationalist narrative that stressed that we once had independence, we were once separate, and we were forced into this bargain with Libya, and we're just waiting for a chance to get out. I think historically, like a lot of nationalism, that's a historical myth, but it's quite potent, and it's become more potent since the collapse of the Libyan state in 2011, especially since the civil war in 2014. There are a lot of people in the Green Mountains areas in Derna and Benghazi who really feel like Cyrenaica is ethnically and politically and culturally separate and distinct from Tripolitania, and should have its own political entity, should have its own self-determination. And they're looking for international partners to make that work. They've made this, the Federalist Movement has made a kind of a bargain with General Haftar, probably the strongest military commander in Libya right now. But that's really a marriage of convenience. Haftar is not especially sympathetic to the idea of Cyrenaican separatism, but he's used their forces to try and fight common enemies, particularly the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamist groups that had been operating in Benghazi and areas in the east. Now, in the last 6 months or so, Haftar has been making his push. He's moving into the south and trying to sort of encircle Tripoli. It's not clear, though, if Haftar moves his base of operations from the east, from Benghazi into Tripoli, whether the separatist forces will follow him. I think there is a sense that if Haftar relocates, then the bargain is off, and the separatist movements might push again for independence.
The legacy of past states is a really interesting thread throughout this book, and you speak to the sophistication of these separatist actors by using these historical states to claim legitimacy from the international community, even within the constraints of current borders. Can you tell us about these missing states and how they have enduring power?
I think that conquered states are the platform by which many separatists make their claims to seek their own sovereignty. And the idea that we once had a state and lost it, really in recent memory, is a really important claim for a couple of different reasons. First, it works in the international community because by going to the United Nations or another international actor and showing them a map that says, this is our country, it's on the map. For various reasons, we got taken off the map, but you could reinstate us. We were once a member of the club of states, and we want back in. And not just that we can want back in, but that we can help the international community if you let us back in. We can do the things that you want us to do. We can fight against radical Islamist terrorists. We can ensure that there's stability at the borders. We can keep the oil flowing. These are all promises that separatists make based on the idea that we once had sovereignty and we lost it for a no good reason. So now is a chance to correct that mistake. At the domestic level, the idea of a lost statehood is also very important because it becomes a kind of focal point for political organizations domestically. If you imagine a situation like persisted in Syria in 2011, 2012, or in Libya in 2014, or Yemen, where there was really a kind of collapse of the state, and the state's demands on people's identities really kind of evaporated, people have a lot of different choices about how they want to organize their social life. They can join an Islamist group that talks about pan-Islamic unity and the cooperation amongst Muslims. They can join sectarian groups, sort of saying a Shia group or a Sunni group. They can join an ethno-linguistic group. They can join a sports club. They can join a tribal group. They can join a neighborhood association. And all of these things kind of had an efflorescence in the wake of the uprisings because the states weren't there to kind of crush them. Why would you join a separatist movement? Why would you wager your political fate on the idea that we're going to create a new state? Well, I think one of the reasons is that you have a pre-existing structure, a pre-existing platform that you can point to and say, this once existed and it can exist again. So conquered states, lost autonomy, gives a pre-existing basis for political mobilization. These conquered states often have political parties that were associated with them. They have constitutions, they have national anthems, they have flags. They don't need to be reinvented in that regard. All they really need is to have the recognition, and they can exist. On the other hand, other kinds of social movements have to create all of that stuff from scratch, and that's much harder. So I think that the idea of conquered states, these pre-existing states, states like the Kingdom of Kurdistan that died in 1923, or South Yemen that died in 1991, or Cyrenaica that died in 1951, those become a kind of a ready-made political program for actors that are looking to assert political dominance.
So that's a great segue to the next case study, which is about Yemen and the Southern Movement. Can you tell us more about your work there?
Yemen is another country that I think is relatively understudied in certainly in American discourse. Although there's a much more substantial amount of knowledge about Yemen than there was about Libya. The Yemen unification in the early 1990s between South Yemen and North Yemen was considered at the time to be a kind of one of the high points of Arab unity and a harbinger of kind of good things to come for the region. It didn't turn out that way, though. Almost immediately, there was a sense of regret amongst the leaders of the South Yemeni state about the way that they were treated in the unified Yemen by Ali Abdullah Saleh. Saleh, again, was not necessarily anti-Southern, but he was quite jealous of political power, and he was quite hostile to any kind of political movement that might challenge or block him. There was a civil war in 1994 in Yemen that the North won, kind of reconfirming the unification. And beginning in the 2000s, there was a number of political protest lines that complained about the economic and political marginalization of the South. The story, in some respects, is similar to the story of Cyrenaica. South Yemen's oil wealth was being diverted to serve the North. Some of the major corporations and other kinds of centers of political and economic power were relocated from Aden and moved into Sana'a. By the mid-2000s, Yemen had a number of different political conflicts going on, a conflict with the Houthis in the far north, conflict with al-Qaeda and radical groups kind of nationwide, and then a conflict in the south. The south was probably the most violent one by the mid-2000s. And the Southern Movement, which later became what we call the Southern Resistance, pushed this idea of at least a federal system and possibly even redivision of North and South Yemen, but they were politically really under control. They could create instability, but didn't have a real opportunity for political advancement until the uprising. When the uprising happened in 2011, the state really broke down, and the political control, the military control that the central government had enjoyed in Aden and parts in the south, Hadhramaut and those kinds of areas, dissipated, and separatist actors were able to take over some of the most important infrastructure in the south, oil installations, the major ports, the airport, some of the major transit routes that connected Yemen into Oman. The separatist actors, the Southern Movement, were also able to establish political ties, particularly with the Emirates and Saudi Arabia, that had their own political agenda for trying to in Yemen. As the war between the Houthis and the central government escalated in 2013, 2014, and Saudi Arabia and Yemen committed troops and air forces to fighting the Houthis, the Southern Movement became the kind of the vanguard, the ground soldiers for the Arab coalition that was fighting the Houthis in the far north. There was a kind of tentative alliance between the Southern Movement and what was called the legitimate government, the pro-U.S. government of Hadi. But practically, there was never a real kind of political accord. And every time Hadi tried to assert control or has tried to assert control over the Southern Movement, he's been rejected. The Southern Movement is a purely titular relationship under the central government. So right now, as peace negotiations are proceeding to try and resolve the issues for northern Yemen, the fight between the central government and the Houthis, the Southern Resistance has made clear that they don't feel bound by that by those agreements, and that if the central government tries to reassert its control over Aden and Hadhramaut, they are intending to fight. And frankly, they would win. There's no question about the balance of political power, a balance of military power right now.
How has oil revenue impacted the development of states and the corresponding institutions required to support civil society?
Every separatist actor that I dealt with believed that controlling oil would be a way to get the attention of the international community. They believed that if they had oil, they would at least get a hearing with the U.S. or other regional powers. I'm not sure whether that assessment was right, though. I think that many of these separatist movements actually overestimated how important oil was to their partners. Yes, it's true that they could sell oil on the black market and derive revenue from it. The Islamic State was one of the most well-known examples of this. But the Kurdish actors did the same thing. The South Yemeni separatists have been trying to do that. The Cyrenaicans had a number of different attempts to try and sell oil in the international market. It turns out, though, that it's not just enough to have possession of the oil. You also have to have international bank accounts that deposits can be made in. You have to have a kind of a financial infrastructure that exists in London or New York where international transactions can happen. If you don't have that, if you don't have a partner who you can work with, oftentimes you end up selling oil kind of at below cost. They ended up losing money on certain different transactions, or kind of really just giving it away because no one was willing to work with a renegade or a rogue operation. So where the separatist actors thought that oil was kind of their trump card, that this was the way that they would get the attention of the international community, I think that they were often disappointed in how readily the international community would work with them.
The last two case studies look at Kurdistan and the Islamic State. And I found it interesting that you put these in some context, going back to the Gulf War and the subsequent no-fly zones and sanctions imposed on Iraq. Can you talk about the global nation-state crisis and how it dovetails with these case studies?
We often think about the international system as something that begins in the north and trickles down to the south, that the major decisions made in Geneva or London or Washington are taken, and then they have consequences for the rest of the world. In my research, one of the things that I was surprised to conclude was that Iraq was in some respects the kind of the bellwether of changes in the international systems beginning in the 1990s. After the Gulf War, the 1990-1991 Gulf War, Iraq was a kind of a prism by which all of the major debates about how the international system could work were viewed. Things like whether or not to have humanitarian intervention, about the role of sovereignty, about self-determination, about international sanctions. These are all things that played out in Iraq during the 1990s. The creation of the no-fly zone in 1991 that protected what became the Kurdish region, at that time was called the Kurdish Regional Government, and that now we call it the Kurdish region, was the product of a kind of a dissensus, a disagreement in the international community about how you could implement humanitarian interventions and at the same time preserve sovereignty. And it was really a reflection of a compromise between this idea that, well, you have to provide humanitarian protection because Saddam is a madman and he'll do terrible things. But on the other hand, we have to keep Iraq sovereign and territorial and keep its territorial integrity intact. And so the no-fly zone was a kind of a compromise, right? That it didn't allow Kurds to have their own state, but it did allow for humanitarian intervention. The 2003 invasion of Iraq, I think, made those tensions even more palpable, even more clear. And again, Iraq was the kind of the bellwether by which we evaluate newer ideas like responsibility to protect. With the invasion, the U.S. again insisted that Iraq remain intact, but allowed the Kurdish actors to have even more political autonomy and even political legitimacy because they were no longer this kind of anomaly sitting in the northern Iraq, sovereign but not sovereign. But now they had a fully fledged political apparatus attached to Iraq. At the same time, the U.S. invasion disempowered Iraq's Sunni Arab leadership, which had really been the kind of the dominant force in Iraq beginning in 1921. Except for a brief period in the 1950s, every ruler of Iraq from 2001 until 2003 had been a Sunni Arab. And this sense of disempowerment, the sense of being removed from power and losing control over the state, pushed Sunni Arabs, both in Iraq but also in neighboring Syria, to reconsider their commitment to Iraq. So where Kurds in 2003 were sort of forced into this kind of unhappy marriage with to remain in an unhappy marriage with Iraq, Sunni Arabs were pushed to reconsider how their commitments to Iraq. The emergence of groups like Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia under Abu Musab Zarqawi, and then the Islamic State splinter that came later in 2010, well, actually a little bit in 2007, 2008, but it came to its full fruition in 2010, 2011. The emergence of the Islamic State was a kind of represented the rejection of this Iraqi state that Sunni Arabs had once dominated. So you have, on one hand, you have Kurds that are being pulled into Iraq and forced to cooperate forced to operate within an Iraqi sovereign sphere, and Sunni Arabs who had once considered Iraq to be really their state to think about the possibilities of creating a different state under an entirely different rubric. This idea of a global caliphate that represented Sunni orthodoxy reigning supreme, that was represented the rejection of the Iraqi state that had once been firmly under their control. So the Kurdish separatist movement and the Islamic State are kind of these twins that experience the same kind of crises but go in very different directions in response to them.
In several of the case studies, you mentioned the friends of groups and their role in fundraising and managing state resources. Can you tell us more about this?
Early on in the uprisings in 2011, a combination of exile actors living in the diaspora and some kind of political entrepreneurs working with the rebel groups on the ground realized that the only way that they were going to succeed was to attract the support of the international community and build a kind of a global consensus in support of their movement. These were not separatist actors. They were anti-regime actors, but they adopted a kind of a common playbook to try and get support of the international community. One of the things that they wanted to do was to try and get control over the country's finances. I mentioned earlier how the only way you can really sell oil at a decent price is if you have an interlocutor, a buyer on the other end who has a bank account in New York or London, right? You have to have access to the international financial networks. And what these actors did was they lobbied the international community to essentially take the name of the country off the checkbook, to make it so that it was no longer Muammar Gaddafi or Ben Ali or Saddam, or Bashar al-Assad's name to signature, take their name off this as a signature off the checkbook, and put it in the control of the international community, and preferably under the control of the exiles. The emergence of the Friends of Syria, Friends of Yemen, Friends of Libya groups, these kind of large donor groups, represented this idea that the international community, the U.S. in particular, but the international community was going to sort of suspend the economic sovereignty of these countries until they started doing the right thing. This move, though, the Friends of, was done with the idea that this was a temporary measure that would allow the rebels to get economic resources and then make a push to take over the government. And then the Friends of group would step in and become a kind of a funder. What it ultimately did, though, was it ultimately rendered these countries meaningless entirely, right? If your country is going to be in receivership, if Libya is essentially, if its entire financial system is being controlled by the Friends of group and being operated in Geneva or London, then what's the point of having Libya exist in any form anyway? And that opened up the possibility for separatist actors to say, look, Libya is a failed experiment. Libya hasn't worked. Yemen is a failed experiment. Libya, look at what's happened. It's in receivership. The international community is controlling its finances. If that's the case, then why don't you give us a go? Let us have a try at our sovereignty, and we can do a better job than what has been really kind of decades, if not a century, of failure.
Turning to the last case study, you say that the Islamic State was the most disruptive claimant to sovereign statehood to emerge after 2011. Can you talk about why that is and the implications on the global order?
The Islamic State is the black sheep among the separatist groups. In fact, one of the most common critiques I get when I talk about this book is that the Islamic State wasn't a separatist actor at all. It was a kind of global jihadi organization that wanted to create an international caliphate. So it doesn't really fit with the cases of Libya, Yemen, or Kurdistan. I disagree. I think that the Islamic State had aspirations to create this global caliphate. It had a lot of kind of millenarial messianic expectations about creating a global order. But that on the ground, functionally, the Islamic State was an activity by Iraqi Sunnis to create a political entity that was separate and apart from the domination of the Iraqi state, and that expanded opportunistically into Libya during the period of the revolution and reestablished the political ties that had gone across the Libyan-Syrian frontier dating back into the Ottoman Empire. I think my favorite chapter or my favorite subchapter in the entire book was a subchapter called the Jazeera Caliphate. People don't often know what the Jazeera is. When King Faisal went to the Versailles Peace Conference in 1919, he had a plan for Arab sovereignty that included the creation of a kind of a triple kingdom. There would be an Arab kingdom of Hejaz, which his father would be the king. There would be a kingdom for Iraq. And he said there would be a kingdom for the Jazeera, which he said was a semi-civilized area that went north, all the areas north of Baghdad between the Tigris and the Euphrates River. So it's essentially the areas that go between Mosul and Aleppo. Ultimately, for kind of geopolitical reasons, Faisal never got his wish. He became the king of Iraq kind of as a consolation prize, and Iraq unified the Ottoman provinces of Basra, Mosul, and Baghdad into a single political entity. But the idea that there is a political and economic, social, cultural, tribal connection that spans from northern Iraq, from the regions around Mosul, all the way to Aleppo, was still there, and the fact that there are the same tribes operate across the border. Many of those tribes were very happy in Iraq because as long as Iraq was Sunni dominated, they represented the privileged ruling elite. When the Iraqi state faltered and collapsed in 2003, was demolished really in 2003, though, they started to reconsider their commitments to this Iraq, right? They were suddenly the odd men out. And then when the revolution happened in Syria, the border itself became even more porous, and the possibilities of creating a political context that would span across the border was open. The Islamic State, in my mind, represented a kind of, is really unexceptional, right? There are lots of movements that have these kind of global aspirations, but are physically operating on the ground in very specific territorial ways. One of the examples, I think, a great example is the Communist Party, of Russia during the revolution. On the one hand, they talked about we're the party of all the workers. We have these grand aspirations to create a global revolution, but practically, and for functional reasons, they're really talking about fighting to reassert control over a particular country. They were Russian nationalists, even at the same time that they were global revolutionaries. And ISIS is the same way. It's a Sunni Arab uprising that talks about global revolution in much the same ways and has the same kind of messianic millenarial ambitions, but practically for functional reasons is operating very locally, right? On the ground, the Islamic State devised its own currency. It had its own education system. It had its own police force, its own justice system. It ran hospitals. It ran hydroelectric plants, right? It became the state, and a state in a very specific territorial way, not a global state, the way that its ideologues and propagandists would have liked you to believe.
Throughout the book, you point to these kinds of political orders that arise when states recede. Can you talk about these new kinds of political organizations and what they mean for the future of states and the international community of states?
When I started writing the book, I expected that I was going to finish the book with independent Iraqi Kurdistan. I was optimistic. I thought that the Barzani government would figure out some way, get recognition and become get international recognition in the way that South Sudan or in Kosovo had. I thought that they also had the best chance to do it. I was wrong, obviously. I was wildly overly optimistic in that respect. Right in 2019, about a year and a half since I finished writing the book, none of the separatist movements have been able to get enough traction to force themselves into the agenda of the international community. None of them have been successful in establishing their own statehood. But they are in a position to be play a role of spoilers, to ruin the chances for reconsolidation of these states. This is especially the case in Yemen, where the southern resistance movement is far and away stronger than the central government and could resist, could block any chance that the central government, the Mahdi government, would reassert control over Hadhramaut, Mara, or Aden. In Iraq, the Kurdish referendum of 2017 was a failure, but I think that the Kurdish nationalist drive is actually all the more is probably because of that rejection is all the more potent. And again, there's been no resolution about between what the Kurds want and what the Iraqi state will offer them. In Syria, the Kurdish resistance stands out as a kind of is the last remaining stronghold not under the control of Bashar al-Assad. And they're looking to find an international sponsor that might allow them to keep some kind of territorial autonomy. And if they don't get that, they're also talking about that they would be willing to fight. Same goes in eastern Libya. So I think that the spoilers are while they've been militarily defeated, they're politically quite potent. And the fact that separatists build off the basis of conquered states means that they're always going to be resurgent. These ideas about creating a separate state will not go away. Shifting to the international community, the perspective from the international community, these separatists, I think, show the limits of the idea of pursuing proxy warfare, of engaging separatists or other kinds of armed actors on a temporary ad hoc basis just for short-term gains. The U.S. and other actors were reluctant to try to committing troops to these areas, and so they were always looking for a partner. And with the exception of the Islamic State, each of these groups were partners in the global war on terror, and each of them got burned for doing it. None of them got the results, the recognition, the support that they expected to get for doing it. And I think that will have a long lasting legacy for the way separatist actors relate to the global community and how the global community engages with separatist actors.
Ariel, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we let you go, would you tell us what you're working on now?
Sure. I've been lucky to receive some funding from the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working with Ranj Alaaddin, a fellow at the Brookings Institution in Doha, to do a project on proxy wars in the Middle East and try and think about some new and inventive ways to resolve conflicts in the Middle East that don't involve simply just reconsolidating state control. I think we've been waiting for the reconsolidation of state control in Yemen, in Libya. We'll be waiting a very long time. I think that our project looks at alternative ways of engaging armed non-state actors in a way that doesn't necessitate strong states.
That sounds like a great project. Thanks for coming on today and talking about your book.
Thank you for having me.
Break All the Borders, Separatism and the Reshaping of the Middle East by Ariel Aram is available now from Oxford University Press. Thanks for listening to New Books in National Security, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.